2. Numbers chapter 22. And I want to read just verse number 1, and then we'll pray, and then we'll work through many more verses as we go. So Numbers chapter 22 and verse number 1, and the children of Israel set forward and pitched in the plains of Moab on this side Jordan by Jericho. And Jericho is, so there, so if you think of the Missouri River kind of like the Jordan, although the Missouri is bigger, wider certainly than the Jordan River is, then the Moab side would be the east side, towards Council Bluffs side, and Jericho would be on the Omaha side. It's a kind of a little oasis city there, just kind of northeast of, very close to, but a little bit northeast of Jerusalem. So at this point, and we're going to pray in a second, but I read that first verse because entering chapter 22, we have reached the third and final geographic marker in the book of Numbers. The book is divided into an account of Israel in the camp, and then in chapter 10, they begin to march, and all the way through the end of chapter 21, they are in the wilderness, and now through the end of the book, they are in Moab. This becomes kind of the staging area for them to cross over the Jordan and come into the promised land. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this book and for our time together, and I pray always, Lord, for us that we all would be good students of your word, that you would enable me to speak your words faithfully and accurately, and that we would receive them as they are the word of truth. And I pray this for us in Jesus' name. Amen. So there's obviously a rather lengthy stay here, or at least a substantial part of the book of Numbers takes place here. There, I can't remember right off the top of my head, 35, 36 chapters in the book of Numbers, so we still have a long way to go. But the first thing we deal with when we come into this final geographical section is a lengthy portion of the book dealing with this man, Balaam. He is the subject matter of chapter 22, 23, and 24. He is a major Bible character. he is mentioned 63 times in the Bible. He is mentioned by the Old Testament prophet Micah chapter 6, verse number 5. He is mentioned in New Testament books of 2 Peter, Jude, and Revelation. he is, and one of the things, in fact, really my primary intention this evening is to help us to clear this up. He is a little bit of a mystery man to many people. Because at first glance, he seems to come off as a rather pleasant, ordinary, afflicted with the same kind of afflictions that we are, but otherwise harmless guy in Numbers chapter 22. And the reality is that nothing could be further from the truth. he is condemned roundly, completely, thoroughly. He is never commended in any way at any time. And I propose to endeavor this evening to show you, even from this rendition in Numbers 22, that he is sketchy. And he is killed later in the book by the Israelites because they have gone to war against Midian, and Balaam is apparently a part of the army that is fighting, and he is killed. And yet from the mouth of this man comes one of the greatest and clearest Old Testament prophecies about the Messiah. and one of the things, folks, that I am hoping to persuade us of is that when we read the account of a man like Balaam, that our focus should not be upon the kind of man that Balaam is. Because the story is really not about the kind of man that Balaam is. The story is really about the kind of God Jehovah is. And we tend very much, because we are mortals and we are humans, to come to our Bibles and always begin with the human dimension. Tell me about the character. But the Bible is ultimately and primarily a book about God and who He is. So we're gonna take some time this evening. We're gonna walk through the events through verse number 35 or 36. And I will admit there that it gets a little complicated chronologically. But the story really unfolds to us in a very orderly fashion. And I don't want to get, all taken up with this, but if you wanted to do the work and do the time, you would discover that the story of Balaam is told in an incredible set of multiples of three. We see them pretty quickly. if you look at verse number 28, the Lord opened the mouth of the ass. verse number 32, and the angel of the Lord said unto him, wherefore hast thou smitten thine ass these three times? And verse number 33, and the ass saw me and turned from me these three times. We have these multiples of three. The donkey tries to avoid the angel of the Lord three times. Balaam makes arrangements for three sets of offerings. We'll deal with that in chapter 23. Balaam has three encounters with God. There are actually six distinct main acts, so to speak. Each of them is divided into two sets of three. And each of those is set off by Balaam's proclamation that he will only say what God tells him to say. And the whole thing takes place over three sets of consecutive days, which is the way that we'll kind of follow the story. We're going to try to follow it by the rising and setting of the sun, so to speak. So verses 1 through 14 then, or actually verses 2 through 14, take us through this first set of 2 days, day 1 and day 2. And Balak the son of Zippor saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. And you've got to kind of keep in your mind these people, because they're different people and it's important to know who they are. Okay? So Balak the son of Zippor saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. That's chapter 21 and their destruction. And Moab was sore afraid of the people because they were many, and Moab was distressed because of the children of Israel. And Moab said unto the elders of Midian, now it's a different group of people, now shall this company lick up all that are around about us, as the ox licketh up the grass of the field. And Balak the son of Zippor was king of the Moabites at that time. He sent messengers therefore unto Balaam the son of Beor to Pethor, which is by the river of the land of the children of his people, to call him, saying, behold, there is a people come out from Egypt. Behold, they cover the face of the earth, and they abide over against me. Come now therefore, I pray thee, curse me this people, for they are too mighty for me. Peradventure I shall prevail, that we may smite them, that I may drive them out of the land. For I wot that he whom thou blessest is blessed, and he whom thou cursest is cursed. And the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the rewards of divination in their hand. And they came unto Balaam and spake unto him the words of Balak. And he said unto them, lodge here this night, and I will bring you word again as the Lord shall speak unto me. And the princes of Moab abode with Balaam. And God came unto Balaam and said, what men are these with thee? And Balaam said unto God, Balak the son of Zippor, king of Moab, hath sent unto me, saying, behold, there is a people come out of Egypt, which covereth the face of the earth. Come now, curse me them. Peradventure I shall be able to overcome them and drive them out. And God said unto Balaam, thou shalt not go with them. Thou shalt not curse the people, for they are blessed. And Balaam rose up in the morning and said unto the princes of Balak, get you into your land, for the Lord refuseth to give me leave to go with you. And the princes of Moab rose up, and they went unto Balak and said, Balaam refuseth to come with us. So we're gonna stop there. Okay? That's our first section. So Israel arrives on the east side of Jordan near the oasis village of Jericho. The Moabites are descendants of Lot. And they're introduced to us in Genesis chapter 19. The Midianites are descendants of Abraham. After Sarah died, Abraham married Keturah, and one of the children that Abraham had with Keturah was Midian. So these are the two people, and they have some form of confederation. And if you are inclined to read scholarly articles and like the deeper commentaries, you'll know there's some turmoil over this because Moab and Midian are not necessarily geographically connected together, and how did that all work? And this is one of the ways that liberals question the integrity of the Bible, and we're not going to go down that road. The Moabites and the Midianites are part of the story. Moabite leadership panics, and they are evidently the larger part of the confederation. Right? I mean, you know, the United States fought in alliance with England in World War II. When it came to the European theater, an American general was in charge, Eisenhower. So we have an alliance of Midian and Moab, but evidently the king of Moab is dominant in calling the shots. So he heard about what happened to the Amorites, and Numbers 21:35 tells us that they were destroyed. They smote him, the king of Amorites, and his sons and all his people until there was none left him alive, and they possessed his land. And Moab makes the conclusion, we are next. And then he utters one of the most fabulous word pictures in all of the Bible. They will lick us up like an ox licks up the grass. And you can just see the cows pulling off tufts of grass, and that being the Moabites. What to do? And one of the things we want always to remember is that while we view even our religion oftentimes through secular eyes, these people saw the world and everything in it through religious eyes. So everything was religious to them. And so the solution is to hire the most effective and evidently most famous of the pagan prophets, a man by the name of Balaam. Balaam is not a Moabite and he is not a Midianite. It is possible, actually, that he is an Edomite, but we don't know that. Genesis 36:32 tells us of a man named Beor who was in Edom. And since we keep being told that Balaam is the son of Beor, that could be why. Day 2 takes up then in verse number 8. So this is right day 1. We hire Balaam and we hire this man, this prophet, and the Moab leadership spends the night with Balaam, and that night God comes and talks to Balaam. Now, God is not on a fact-finding mission. He knows exactly what is going on. And one of the more interesting dimensions of this, folks, is that there is no evidence that Israel knows any of this. As far as we know, the Israelites are totally in the dark as to what is happening here. So Balaam explains the mission, and that's verse 10 and 11. And this is really important for us to grasp the significance of. Balaam said to God, Balak the son of Zippor, king of Moab, hath sent unto me, saying, behold, there is a people come out of Egypt, which covereth the face of the earth. Come now, curse me them. And again, since we are Westerners and we're believing people, but we have this scientific, secular view of the world, that word curse doesn't really send chills up and down our spine. But it is a potent religious concept, okay? And so the goal is to hire Balaam, who will invoke a curse upon them that will sufficiently weaken them that he can defeat them militarily. And I'm just pulling all of that out from what he is saying in verse 11. Come now, curse me them. Peradventure, I shall be able to overcome them and drive them out. So I'm not capable all by myself of defeating them, but if you can invoke this religious curse upon these people, then possibly I will be able to finish them off. The curse is not going to exterminate them, But if you curse them, I will be able to exterminate them. Now, anytime you read something like this, again, folks, right? Our little antenna ought to go off, and we ought to go, what's with the curse? And the answer to what's with the curse goes back to the Abrahamic covenant. Okay? What is at stake here, folks, is the entirety of the Abrahamic covenant and the existence of the Israeli people. In Genesis chapter 12, verses 2 and 3, God said to Abraham, I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, the opposite of cursing, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and I will curse them that curseth thee. And in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. Balak understands in a very limited way what the stakes are. If the Jews come across the river, I'm dead. Actually, he doesn't even need to come across the river. He is across the river. If the Jews come after me, we are goners. But the problem, folks, again, is we're not just talking about, Balak may be thinking about trying to obtain a military victory. But that is not what God knows is going on. God knows what is going on is that the entirety of the Abrahamic covenant is being threatened. And if Balaam, and God functions throughout all of these chapters as if Balaam could possibly bring this kind of a curse. Right? God does not, never says, go ahead, curse them. It means nothing. That is not the way that God treats this. So the ultimate issue, folks, from the outset is who has the power to curse the Israelites? And the answer is no one. And God will go to great lengths to protect the people that he has promised to bless. And this is why God responds the way that he does in verse number 12. God said unto Balaam, thou shalt not go with him, thou shalt not curse the people, for they are blessed. And if Balaam were a genuinely sincere folks, I would propose to you that verse number 13 would be the end of the story. That if Balaam meant what he said, that would be the end of the story. That if Balaam was sincere in honoring and serving God, he would have said, I can't go. That's the end of it. But that is not the end of it. And that is one of the indications that there is much more going on here in the mind of Balaam than the narrator is telling. So with that news, the princes of Moab go back to the king and they say, he's not going. And that brings us to the second set of multiple days, days 3 and 4. And this, I don't know that these are consecutive days, but the story is told in these three sets of 2 days. And that's verses 15 through 31. Balak sent yet again princes and more honorable than they. And they came to Balaam and said unto him, thus saith Balak the son of Zippor, let nothing, I pray thee, hinder thee from coming unto me. For I will promote thee unto very great honor. I will do whatsoever thou sayest unto me. Come therefore, I pray thee, curse me this people. And Balaam answered and said unto the servants of Balak, if Balak would give me his house full of silver and gold, I cannot go beyond the word of the Lord my God to do less or more. Now therefore, I pray you, tarry ye also here this night, that I may know what the Lord will say unto me more. And God came unto Balaam at night and said unto him, if the men come to call thee, rise up and go with them. But yet the word which I shall say unto thee, that shalt thou do. And Balaam rose up in the morning and saddled his ass and went with the princes of Moab. And God's anger was kindled because he went. And the angel of the Lord stood in the way for an adversary against him. Now he was riding upon his ass, and his two servants were with him. And the ass saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way, and his sword drawn in his hand. And the ass turned aside out of the way and went into the field, and Balaam smote the ass to turn her into the way. But the angel of the Lord stood in a path of the vineyards, a wall being on this side and a wall on that side. And when the ass saw the angel of the Lord, she thrust herself under the wall and crushed Balaam's foot against the wall, and he smote her again. And the angel of the Lord went further and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn either to the right hand or to the left. And when the ass saw the angel of the Lord, she fell down under Balaam, and Balaam's anger was kindled, and he smote the ass with a staff. And the Lord opened the mouth of the ass, and she said unto Balaam, "What have I done unto thee, that thou hast smitten me these three times?" And Balaam said unto the ass, "Because thou hast mocked me. I would there were a sword in mine hand, for now would I kill thee." And the ass said unto Balaam, "Am not I thine ass upon which thou hast ridden ever since I was thine unto this day? Was I ever wont to do so unto thee?" And he said, "Nay." Then the Lord opened the eyes of Balaam, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way, and his sword drawn in his hand, and he bowed down his head and fell flat on his face. So, on this next set of days, the Moabite princes return. They do not believe Balaam's proclamation that he's not going. They go, "Let's up the ante. We'll send more princes in quantity, higher in position. We will send more money. We will promote you to very great honor." And Balaam says, "Well, I can't go against God, but let's see if he's got anything new to say." Does he have anything new to say? No. God has had all the time in eternity to rethink this situation, and there's nothing to think about. But God does permit Balaam to go. And again, folks, this should not be seen as some kind of act of kindness or repentance on the part of the Lord. Right? This is the Lord permitting a man to hang himself. Because we could put it this way, here's an opportunity for Balaam to say, "You told me not to go, I'm not going." But that is not what he does. And so when in verse number 21, in the morning, Balaam starts to go, God is angry and the Lord impedes his path. And a donkey talks. Now, what you have, folks, right? What does God think of Balaam? God thinks so little of Balaam that he lets a donkey see what Balaam can't see. And a donkey sees the angel of the Lord with a sword in his hand, and Balaam is saying to his donkey, "If I had a sword, I'd kill you." And there is this series of conversations in which God reiterates his opposition to Balaam's attempt to curse the people. And Balaam admits his wrong. But the Lord does say to him, verse number 32, the angel of the Lord said unto him, "Wherefore hast thou smitten thine ass these three times? Behold, I went out to withstand thee, because thy way is perverse before me. And the ass saw me and turned from me these three times. Unless she had turned from me, surely now also I had slain thee and saved her alive." And Balaam said unto the angel of the Lord, "I have sinned, for I knew not that thou stoodest in the way against me. Now therefore, if it displease thee, I will get me back again." And the angel of the Lord said unto him, "Go with the men, but only the word that I shall speak unto thee, that thou shalt speak." So Balaam went with the princes of Balak. And this, I think, and admittedly, this is where the day-night thing gets a little fuzzy, but right in there is the close of this day. The distance that is required to travel between verses 35 and 36 probably brings us to the end of the day. So he admits his fault, and God says, "Go with them, speak only what I say." And again, folks, because God is at work, and he is going to communicate something to Balak. Right, the Moabites need to hear this, and they're going to hear it through Balaam. So we're going to stop there with our reading, and I just want to take a moment, a couple of minutes, and propose to you that this account all by itself bears adequate evidence against Balaam, that we should not read this story and go, I always get confused here because he seems like kind of a good guy and God seems to use him. But remember, folks, God uses all kinds of wicked people. And that's not a commentary on their goodness. God used wicked King Cyrus. God used wicked Caesar Augustus. God used the wicked high priest that crucified Christ to make a tremendous prediction about the Messiah. The word of the Lord is independent of the quality of the men from whose mouths it comes. This is a hard lesson for human beings to learn, right? And it is incumbent upon those who preach it to live in such a way that their life does not compromise it. But the reality is, folks, if I was the biggest scoundrel on the planet, and in truth, I am a very large scoundrel, the word of the Lord is untainted by my sin. The word of the Lord is pure. And it has an existence that is independent of anybody who preaches it. We're getting ready. We'll deal with that in a little more detail coming up on Sunday mornings. Okay, so let's start with the most obvious. The fact that God tells Balaam no and then lets him do it. Okay, this is not God changing his mind. This is God revealing human hearts. God is pretty clear that we tend to be persistent in our sinful desires. God is equally clear that one of the ways he judges us is by indulging our sinful desires or allowing us to indulge them. He turns our appetites back against us. We are destroyed by those things that are sinful that we love. If God had said no, and Balaam had said no, then Balaam would have been a faithful prophet, but Balaam was never a faithful prophet. And the constant finagling and negotiating are evidences of his heart. He's saying no, but he doesn't mean no. And when Jude condemns him, he says he ran greedily after gain. Right? Balaam had one thing in mind, and that was the negotiating the best possible price for his services. So when we negotiate with God, or somebody does, and it appears that God relents, that's a commentary on us more than it's a commentary on God. Furthermore, the incident with the donkey puts Balaam in his place. Remember, folks, Balaam is, if not the, certainly one of the leading prophets in the world at this time. How is it that the leading prophet in the world could not see what a donkey saw? And by the way, when our King James translators used the word ass, they used that word innocently. It didn't have any of the connotations that we have attached to it in the modern world. It was a word for donkey, like cow is a word for cow. So what kind of prophet can't see what a donkey can see? Thirdly, if Balaam was truly a prophet, I'm going to ask you to turn, if you would, to Deuteronomy chapter 2. If Balaam was truly a prophet, in the sense of being a faithful mouthpiece for Jehovah, he would have known something. You know what he would have known? See, if Balaam were really a prophet of the Lord and Balak said, look, there's this people come out of Egypt and they are just licking up the place like a cow licks up the grass in the field and they're going to destroy us, Balaam would have said, they're not going to lay a finger on you. Deuteronomy chapter 2. Verse number 8, and when we passed by from our brethren, the children of Esau, which dwelt in Seir, through the way of the plain from Elath, and from Ezion Geber, we turned and passed by the way of the wilderness of Moab. And the Lord said unto me, distress not the Moabites, neither contend with them in battle, for I will not give thee of their land for a possession, because I have given Ar unto the children of Lot for a possession. The reality is that the Moabites were in no danger from the Israelites. And a faithful prophet should have had that information. Moses had it. If King Balak had sent a messenger to Moses and said, look, I just want you to know, I'm really nervous about you guys. What are your intentions? Moses would have said, you have nothing to fear from us. We're not after you. But Balaam didn't know that. And he's trying to line his pockets to invoke a curse upon people who at this point in their history have absolutely nothing to do with Moab. And finally, folks, and I'm just going to give you the references because I want to move into the prayer time. But in the text, there is clearly a gulf between God and Balaam. Balaam calls God the Lord, Jehovah, as if he knows him. Yes, I'm one of the prophets and I know Jehovah. But when God talks to him, he's always just God, not Jehovah. Balaam claims to know him, right? I'm a prophet. I'm a diviner. And we'll talk about this, right? Because we're going to offer these sacrifices and we're going to study the entrails of the animals that we have killed so that we can read the message from the gods as to what it is. That's the way Balaam functions. He's a diviner. He's going to read the signs. But he doesn't know the Lord. He just claims to know the Lord. Anybody can claim to know the Lord. So the whole thing, and we'll really see this when we get into this next week, folks, because chapter 23 is written from a position, I think, of satire. The Moabites are being mocked by God in their attempt to curse the Israelites. So, but we'll get into that when we deal with that next week. All right, I'm going to stop there. If you want to grab your